You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 30th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rafia Zakaria, author of Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. Meanwhile, today is Infrastructure Day, at least that's what Nancy Pelosi is saying when she assures that the plan is still to hold the vote on the small bipartisan infrastructure package today, despite progressives showing no signs of moving on the dual-track process that includes the reconciliation bill, as promised. The Biden administration has also begun tamping down expectations for that vote. More on that later. Schumer says the Senate has reached a deal to avert a government shutdown, at least until December 3rd, with a resolution that does not include a debt limit increase. McConnell is still refusing to budge there, but a few Republican senators are still trying to tack on some amendments to the final legislation, including anti-Afghan refugee provisions and banning federal money for vaccine mandates. Lovely. A group of activists staged a protest outside of Biden chief of staff's Ron Klain's home yesterday, bringing a mountain of fake bones with them, outraged over Biden's inaction on global vaccine inequity. This comes as 70% of African countries have been unable to meet the WHO's target of inoculating 10% of their populations. The CDC is urging pregnant women to get vaccinated, reporting that less than a third of pregnant women have been vaccinated. Contracting COVID while pregnant increases the probability of stillbirth and other complications, including hospitalization. And lastly, despite years of hard-fought protests from water protectors, the Enbridge crude oil pipeline that runs across Minnesota has been completed, and the company announced oil will start flowing shortly. However, protesters vow to continue the fight. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today, as he is most Thursdays at this point, unless I am out. And so we have a great show for you today. Looking forward to speaking with Rafaria about Against White Feminism, which is a topic that in particular I think is important to discuss, delineating some of the corporate pro-capitalist feminist messages from a much more inclusive and broader feminist critique. But before that, this is a big day in the news. We have right now an infrastructure fight that is about to hit a boiling point. Today is supposed to be the vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Now, the Biden administration seems to be tamping down expectations for that infrastructure vote today on the bipartisan bill. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm was on CNN's John Berman's show this morning, and she basically said the obvious. It's really okay if the House can't meet the conservative Democrats' arbitrary deadline for a vote on the bipartisan infrastructure package today. She's a curious voice for the Biden administration to deploy in this area, but the fact that she's doing so seems to indicate that hopes are dwindling for the bipartisan bill to be voted on today, which is a good thing. That means that the progressives are holding the line, at least with the information that we have right now. Here is Jennifer Granholm.
It is not some major cataclysm. If there isn't a vote today, there is full support of the president's full Build Back Better agenda. There is some negotiation around the margins about the size of the package, the second package, and what's in it and how that's shaped. But this will get through. I will mark my words, the infrastructure bill will be passed, and a version of the reconciliation bill will be as well.
A version of the reconciliation bill. You will hear right now in the media a lot of Democrats saying a reconciliation package. I believe Nancy Pelosi was quoted this morning essentially saying that a reconciliation package will be agreed upon. I'm trying to find it here, but I don't necessarily have the quote in front of me. Oh, here we go. Nancy Pelosi says, I told members of my leadership that the reconciliation bill was a culmination of my service in Congress. Remove all doubt in anyone's mind that we will not have reconciliation. We will have a reconciliation bill. That's for sure. So you're hearing a lot about this, that a reconciliation bill will be coming down the pike. But the issue with that is that if she still is saying that a vote is going to happen today on the bipartisan infrastructure package, then what is in a reconciliation bill? Well, that is very, very fluid, and that language is important.
It's a failure of leadership that it's a reconciliation bill and not the reconciliation bill, or even better yet, Joe Biden's reconciliation bill. That's a failure of leadership. And to the extent that this gets hacked down by Manchin Sinema, it's because Joe Biden didn't want to take ownership of it.
Well, yes. I had someone ask me yesterday, who doesn't work in this field, you know, if there was one senator, like Sinema, holding up the entire Trump agenda, do you think that Donald Trump would be screaming and berating them and making them feel the pain for holding up his entire agenda? Biden's not doing any of that. Part of that is because he is a believer in these arcane senatorial processes, and he's committed to them in an almost religious fashion. And part of it, too, is that's just like not his leadership style, and it's weak leadership, in my opinion, and as Matt pointed out. And so The issue here, too, is that Pelosi and other members of leadership, Chuck Schumer, there seems to be a bit of a schism between the two on an approach, but Pelosi is trying to thread this needle where she says, okay, well, maybe if we get a pinky promise and we get a public declaration from Manchin and Sinema that even if we do push the bipartisan bill through and we get the progressives on board and we're able to vote yes on this, that we will get a reconciliation bill later. Maybe that will be enough for progressives. It damn well shouldn't be enough for progressives. A pinky promise from Manchin and Sinema? Why would progressives ever trust Manchin and Sinema on reconciliation? You're hearing this language about a firm public commitment from Manchin and Sinema. That's worth less than the paper it's written on, or in, for that matter, because Manchin loves taking out op-eds in the Washington Post and the New York Times to make public declarations that he has immediately backed off of because he uses them as leverage.
Yeah, I promise to you that if you get rid of your leverage and give it all to me, I won't do anything bad with it.
Right. I mean, firm public commitments, like Manchin loves anything that's public because it gets him more attention for his branding exercise. And like Sinema, a public commitment from Sinema, she's like Harley Quinn back there. She's just going to laugh at the chaos as the flames engulf her. I mean, this is just the kind of person that she is. They should not be trusted 100%. And Pelosi is in a difficult position in trying to wrangle all of these members of her caucus. But she does have to step forward and basically say, this was the agreement from the beginning, that these two bills were going to be tied together. Even though the moderate conservative Democrats agreed that they were going to do this dual track process, we really understand now, and a lot of us understood at the beginning, that that was a lie for them to keep progressives out of the negotiation process on the bipartisan infrastructure bill and strike it and pass it with Republicans, which is why McConnell voted for it in the Senate. The guy doesn't do anything that isn't strategic. He did it because he knew this had a good chance of throwing a wrench in the Biden agenda, which is why he chose to do so. They want to keep progressives out of the negotiation process, create an infrastructure package that they would eventually use as a way to kill the second larger bill. And they're attempting to be successful in that. And then the media frames it as the progressives being the ones who are derailing it. No. This was always the agreement. It doesn't matter that the moderates, the conservative Democrats agreement was in bad faith. Oh, progressives should have known that, I guess. No, this was always how it was supposed to go down. And I really appreciate specifically Jayapal and Ro Khanna, of who I've seen. I know Ocasio-Cortez has been vocal about this, but I haven't seen her made this point specifically. Reframe this as we are doing what the Biden administration wants, because that is a kind of talking point that appeals to mainstream normie Democrats in a way, and also the media, to keep them off their backs a little bit, because they're chomping at the bit to blame this on progressives. And if you consistently go on cable news and you say the truth, which is that we are the ones on the side of the Biden agenda, then you've got a chance of staving off the wolves.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like, don't take ownership of this half measure, frankly. Even the $3.5 trillion, and we'll see, maybe we get into Manchin's demands later, but which is a lot less than 3.5. But Bernie has been the best at saying, actually, we've compromised like basically to half of what we wanted, but even more than that. So we're done compromising.
Yes. Bradley, it's hard to read all this, but it seems that because we're sending each other details back and forth, because this is such an evolving situation, but Manchin's proposal to Schumer has leaked. We will get back to you on that in a little bit and look into some of the numbers there later in the program when we have some time to look it over. But for now, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Rafia Zakaria, author of Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. But for now, we will turn to a one Sam Cedar for advertisements. Here you go, Sam.
Thank you, Emma. Hey, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Now, sure you're aware, if you've attempted to go see a therapist, therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. A lot of people found telemedicine to be very helpful, particularly therapy during COVID. And I suspect there's a lot of folks who are just going to stick with that. I found it much more convenient. Obviously, a lot of stress coming out of a pandemic, a lot of stress during a pandemic, a lot of stress when there's not a pandemic. Therapy has been extremely helpful for me. It's always helpful to speak to someone. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you find that it's not a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason with no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, BetterHelp.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the description of this video or podcast, and check it out. Thank you to Aura for sponsoring today's episode. Aura is giving my audience 40% off when you go to aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. Look, think about all your online accounts. You got finances, you got devices. What are you doing to protect them? Because if you're like most people, like me, you're probably reusing your password all over the place. Actually, I try not to do that, but I do that too much. And a data breach to any one of those services could create a lot of problems for you. Every 10 seconds, someone becomes a victim of fraud or identity theft, and a lot of these people never recover their stolen money. All right, so let's talk about how Aura can protect you. Aura is a new type of security service. It protects your online data. It protects your devices with one simple subscription. You get alerted to fraud. You get alerted to threats, and you get alerted fast. If your online accounts or passwords were leaked online, if someone tries to open a bank account in your name, you get alerted quick. It's got an easy online dashboard. Alerts are sent straight to your phone. Aura keeps you in control and guides you through solving any issues. All plans come with a $1 million identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds and experienced U.S.-based customer support that has got your back. So if you want to secure your online presence and you want to do so from hackers and from scammers, check out Aura. You're going to get 40% off all plans when you go to Aura, Aura.com/majority. The link is in the YouTube and the podcast description. Now, back to Emma.
We are back, and we are joined by Rafia Zakaria, author of Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. Rafia, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes.
I'm looking forward to our conversation because, you know, I like to rail against white feminism. And sometimes when I speak about it, I think people have a hard time defining the concept. And your book does a really good job of defining that concept, which, again, people can misappropriate or misunderstand. So we can just start really at the beginning, how to define white feminism. How do we define white feminism?
Thank you so much, Emma. Yeah, you know, that is part of the central project of the book, is to not only define white feminism, but also create a vocabulary that allows people to point it out, right? So in this book, in Against White Feminism, I'm not using white feminism as a racially descriptive category. It's not just a white woman who happens to be a feminist. The category that I'm talking about treats whiteness as an ideology, such that, you know, a brown feminist, for instance, could be a white feminist. It focuses on the proclivity of certain women who refuse to acknowledge the role white racial privilege has played within the feminist movement, and who are committed to maintaining this lie that, you know, ideas, policies, priorities, agendas set up by white women, selected by white women, should be the priorities, agendas, policies that apply to all women. So, you know, it's kind of a wake up call, in the sense that, you know, that points out really the fact that the majority of the world's women are Black, Brown, and Asian, and they don't see their priorities and their interests really reflected in feminism today. So if we are going to make feminism a politically vital movement, there really is no way to do that unless we become critical of how whiteness has privileged, you know, the white woman as the feminist, right? Or the type of woman that everybody else should emulate if they want to be a feminist.
Right. I mean, there are other gradations of this broader definition that you talk about here, right? I'll often derisively talk about the book Lean In, for example. And in your book, you talk about trickle-down feminism and the concept of that as well. Like, a lot of this just stems back to feminism within capitalism as well. I guess if we're starting at the top of the flowchart with white feminism there, and I mentioned a few broader concepts, can we just flesh out, and if you don't mind doing this for us, fleshing out what that looks like, especially in 21st century America and under capitalism?
Yes. You know, so not all, you know, there is a history of anti-capitalism within white feminism, right? But what I talk about in the book is how capitalism essentially, selects a feminism that is most friendly to, you know, to its precepts. And so the model of feminism that lives out post the 60s and 70s is precisely what you said, the girl boss lean in feminism, where the idea of success is this very sort of ruthlessly individualistic success, where the idea is that, you know, I have to like mow as many people down as possible in my race to the top. And that's an entirely legitimate idea of feminism and success. So obviously I'm posing, suggesting a very different model, which is, the charge to, for instance, for all women, regardless of race, to consider investing in collective successes, right? In the idea of sisterhood, not as a sort of rejection of your personal ambition, but sisterhood as a politically vital and grounding force that gives to all women. I think that right now, at this moment, we are in a moment which I would say of the transformation of our racial, differences in power. Everything is changing from the workplace to how we work to how we socialize. And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity right now, for us to change feminism, for us to make it, for us to resuscitate it. And I say that in particular because I've been shocked at the reactions of some kind of older white feminists who essentially do not understand that feminism in its current state, like we have it today, is essentially, it's a completely uninteresting, irrelevant category for the majority of the world's women.
Yeah. So have you noticed this conversation being different in U.S. circles versus, say, like in Europe, where there is a lot of whiteness as well? But maybe the individualist capitalist culture isn't as I guess, dominant as it is in the United States.
I've seen a huge difference in the reaction to the book in the US versus the UK, but it's not been along the lines that you suggest. I think the difference, and it has, once again made me realize just how lucky I am to have the precedent of Black women, civil rights leaders, women like, Audre Lorde, and then more recently, women like Mickey Kendall, Kimberly Crenshaw, who have laid a foundation for feminist critiques of race. And, that's just like not the case in the UK. So and of course, the UK is historically more implicated in colonialism and empire. But I've been shocked to see that it's still acceptable in the UK to say that women of color shouldn't be allowed to critique white feminism, for instance, just like that blanket kind of thing, where every attempt at conversation is interpreted as an attack or going for the jugular or, these kinds of very, these statements that definitely demonize feminism that comes from a different racial background. My expectations were actually exactly like yours. I thought that those cultures tend to be less individualistic, less sort of adhere to this kind of ruthless capitalism that we've long, you know, had over here in the U.S. But instead, I found like a virulence, and you know, it's almost like the discussion was it would have been in Jim Crow era United States, you know, where the civil rights movement just hadn't happened yet. So that's been both puzzling but also interesting in terms of, you know, where even white and Western cultures are in terms of their conversations about race.
Yeah, well, it's a little refreshing since we're on this program. We're off.
I know, right? I've been shocked. I really have been so shocked.
Yeah, you mentioned, and one of my favorite focuses of your book are just like the contours of colonialism in the way that some of white feminism manifests itself today. And again, like, we're using your term, I'm as white as it gets. I'm very consciously aware of that. But
you're not a white feminist.
Well, right. I'm attempting. So, I mean, like, how United States foreign policy furthers a lot of this is just such an important conversation, especially in the wake of how the media reacted to the Afghanistan withdrawal, for example, and the Taliban takeover there. And I mean, you touch on this a lot in your book. I guess I'll just want to give you an opportunity to react to that within the framework of a lot of your research. How a lot of white feminists basically talked about how outrageous it was for the United States' military presence to be gone in Afghanistan, because what would that do to feminism, right, in Afghanistan? And a lot of this is about white saviorism as well. So I'm wondering what your take was on these recent news.
Yes, you know, as I say in the book, I call the war in Afghanistan as the United States' first, quote, feminist war. And the reason why I do that is because of the way in which the vocabulary, the language, the ideas, even to some extent, of feminism were co-opted by the larger war project, right? The Bush administration was looking to invade a country to have this very visible show of power, and in response to the 9/11 attacks, it couldn't attack Saudi Arabia, where most of the hijackers were from, because that would endanger the oil supply. So they settled on Afghanistan, and what they did is take an existing, campaign to end gender apartheid that was being run by feminist majority at the time. And they essentially rolled that into their war campaign. And to the extent that leaders from the feminist majority were present to discuss this with White House and State Department officials, and were present when Colin Powell announced the invasion of Afghanistan. So I think, one of the reasons feminism has become irrelevant to so much of the world is because American feminism, at least, or white and Western feminism, perhaps at large, allied itself with this 20-year invasion and occupation of a country, mind you, whose indigenous women on the ground at the time were begging, just begging and imploring the United States to not invade their country. So, so essentially the value of Afghan women to the U.S. has not been anything more than essentially political pawns, against who or behind who they can hide their bombs, right? So it's all the school building and skateboarding and things like that that are being shown to the public at home, to Americans. while, you know, the drownings, the bombings, the night raids, the indefinite detention of hundreds of thousands of Afghans at Bagram, all of that is sort of, you know, it's pushed behind this kind of visibly glitzy wrapping of women's rights. And the tragedy is that, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, is that, you know, 20 years later, this August, you know, it was like almost like getting punched in the face for me, because I would have thought that the U.S. had learned something about Afghanistan and Afghan women, you know, in those 20 years, but it absolutely hadn't. It was the same sort of reductionist stuff where it's like, ooh, I wear the burqa, I'm oppressed. Ooh, I take off the burqa, I'm no longer oppressed. You know, this kind of political theater, to the extent that the congresswoman who did that literally did what I just described on the floor of the House, wore a burqa to the Met Gala. You know, so it, and you know, the anchors from wherever, Fox, CNN, etc., were roaming around the streets of Kabul. In fact, I had an Afghan woman tell me that these blonde white anchors who are making all this political theater of wearing a burqa on the streets of Kabul are making my life difficult, because they're setting this. There's no rule, right? Like, telling me to wear the burqa right now. But these women are almost encouraging that contrast, that, you know, where, you know, if the Taliban come in, they should impose the burqa. And they're making it a problem for me. But of course, there's no realization of that, right? And so in this sense, this book tries to show the damage that allying with an invasion and an occupation has done to the credibility of, you know, Western feminism, and implores people to consider that the story of feminism should not be just centered around white and Western women. Other women, trust me, have won even more significant struggles than just getting the vote. You know, brown women in India have defeated colonialism at the same time, but nobody ever talks about them as feminist heroines. So, you know, I mean, I think the book tries to create a conversation by really asking white women who continue to be in charge of, you know, the discourse by and large, to consider why brown and black, you know, women have essentially signed off.
Right. I mean, and all of these are systems of power that are being challenged in their own specific way through feminism that isn't just like the dominant capitalist hegemonic white feminism. That's the only thing that's portrayed. And that in and of itself creates power systems. And that should be a project of deconstruction and one of intersectionality, which I'm surprised we've gotten this far into our conversation and not talked about that word. That I think it is lost, especially when white feminism is so openly and almost proudly capitalist in the way it's manifested itself.
Right. Because, you know, intersectionality centrally tries to diffuse power along a lot of interstices, along a lot of intersections, essentially, while, you know, capitalist white feminism wants to concentrate it usually within one race. And, you know, and that is also the difference between what I'm calling trickle-down feminism. I mean, and essentially, intersectionality wants a grassroots-up feminism that begins with sort of transformations around communities and political, essentially, struggle and organizing, as opposed to the trickle-down feminism, you know, which is like thought up by a number, like the 10 white women in New York City who are the professionalized feminist, you know, mouthpieces,
The time's up board, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
time's
exactly.
Time's up. Yeah. Right. I guess I want, you mentioned women's suffrage in the United States, and I did appreciate your focus on how the women's suffrage movement in the U.S. was not every white feminist who was involved, but many white feminists wanted to exclude black women from the process, and non-white women, indigenous women, of course, as well. Just historically, I guess, we mentioned how neoliberal kind of capitalist white feminism came into prominence 60s and 70s. But before that, at the turn of the 20th century, what was some of what you found in your research for this book about that era and the birth of white feminism in that time?
Yeah, I mean, to give a snapshot to your readers, you know, think of 1893, when the World's Fair was being held in Chicago, and the Columbian Exposition. And this was the first time women had not yet won suffrage, but the suffrage movement was in full force at the time. And it was the first time that in a World's Fair, women were given this huge building, in which the idea was that they would showcase the, you know, how the American woman was the modern, progressive, emerging leader, you know, the best among women, by showcasing all their achievements. And I will tell you that, of course, the board to run this women's building was all white, made up of all white women. Eventually headed by a rich socialite like, you know, a Melinda Gates type figure, but not divorced, actually still married to her rich husband. And, you know, black women just implored and wrote and wrote and asked and pleaded and demanded that their accomplishments also be included in this, you know, building that would have thousands, going to have thousands and thousands, thousands of exhibits. And all that they gave black women was one little glass case with a book about women in African-American women in upstate New York. That's all. That's all that they got. And the reason I present that snapshot is because, you know, a few decades later, when suffrage was won, it was technically won. Like, black women could technically vote. But what was actually happening in the South was basically that, you know, mobs of unruly and angry people would try to accost any black women that were trying to vote. Or city and county officials would demand IDs or whatever else at the time. That would essentially not allow women to vote, black women to vote. And so, you know, the realities of how long it takes to actually be able to exercise a right is, I think, an integral part of the white feminist story. And it's, you know, and one of the thoughts behind this book was that I wanted to connect those historical examples to what is happening in our contemporary, you know, world. One very, very common thing, for instance, that white women do is, and this is an example of gaslighting, where, you know, some woman of color will tell of an experience that she's had where she's faced racial harassment, you know, or been dismissed or disregarded. And immediately they'll go, well, did that person say that it was your race? That was, you know, the reason that they did that? And, you know, of course, in 2021, just like back then, nobody gives an announcement, oh, we're not going to let black women vote, right? And it's the same right now where we're not going to let brown women speak unless they support our agenda. Nobody provides me a note saying, hey, you know, it's because of your skin color that I don't like you and that I think you are lesser than me and oppressed and require me to save you. But that is the paradigm that we have. And, you know, unfortunately, white and Western feminism is very addicted to this paradigm of wanting to save women here and save women there, because it burnishes their own credentials as women who are very empowered and, you know, the girl bosses of feminism.
Yeah. So I guess I would love if you could expand on the white savior element within white feminism, because like, that kind of that trope has bothered me for as long as I can remember, honestly, and it's self-righteousness and the elevation of oneself while being ostensibly a savior. What did you find when writing about that? And if you could explain that concept to people.
Well, the first thing I'll say is, which all white women can and should do if they listen to this, it's that if you see your fellow white women posting pictures with black children or with brown children or with poor women in India or Africa or wherever, please tell them to take those down. And the reason why I say that is this white savior industrial complex relies on using essentially brown and black people as props to showcase, you know, the moral goodness of the white savior who is there selflessly, altruistically, you know, is just out there to provide help, et cetera, et cetera. What I deconstruct in the book is that the white savior or the white person doing that is not there just to help. They're there because they get a certain kind of emotional and mental high about having power over someone and then helping them, right? That's something that is very real. And that is something that, white society has relied on to essentially ensure that it is always considered morally superior to all those, you know, horrible black and brown people. And it's the same within feminism, right? I'm considered less of a feminist because my culture is shown as inherently feminist and backward and oppressive, right? And because of that, I can never be as good as a white feminist because they come from a culture that presents itself as inherently empowered, which is very, very far from the truth. Four out of five women of color in the U.S., one out of five women of color in the U.S. lives in poverty, right? So obviously there are, or if you take the U.K., you know, I looked at a statistic that said 144,000 women were raped in the U.K., but there were only 1,400 prosecutions. That's not even a conviction. That's just a prosecution. Now, I could look at that statistic and say, wow, this shows a widespread cultural acceptance of rape in this society because hundreds of thousands of them are not even getting prosecuted. But that's never said. It's always considered a one-off, right? When a gender crime happens in the United States or UK or the rest of Europe. However, if, you know, a man kills his wife in Kabul, that's an honor killing. Right. So it's not just femicide. It's has this added cultural component. And what I argue in the book is that there are no inherently feminist or unfeminist cultures. Right. And unless we take this weird hierarchy away, where only white women are celebrated as heroines and black and brown women are just there to tell their stories of trauma, unless we attend to that, we will never understand that women's empowerment and feminism, it should be and is in reality something that is found in all cultures and that women all over the world are struggling to have and to, you know, and to use as a vehicle for magnifying their presence and their voices. So yes, I mean, I think that until we do that, until we stop using brown and black women or children as props to showcase white goodness, you know, this power dynamic is not going to cease.
Right, but on the other hand, we wear bikinis in this country, so I'm joking. I'm joking.
No, I mean, no, but, you know, it's a joke, but, and I would laugh at it as a joke if it wasn't, like, the mainstream belief. Like, it's frustrating, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, that's what the vast majority of white women think. Or American women think that if we have the power to do that, that amounts to some sort of empowerment. And, you know, the book talks about that too. It talks about how, you know, sexual liberation should be a part of women's empowerment, but it shouldn't be the sum total of women's empowerment where you just prance about in your bikini, you know. But 75%, you know, more than that, women who are killed are being killed by their intimate partners. So, I mean, you know, that is something that it's going to take a lot of us and a lot of voices to essentially, you know, wrench this ridiculous idea that, you know, just because you can perform a kind of sexual liberation by wearing a bikini or, you know, by any other way, that equals being empowered, because it does.
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you a little bit before, you know, we run out of time about you mentioned just how you have been treated, and you touched on it a little bit, but you talk about your personal story in the book as well. And if you feel comfortable, I mean, I'd love if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how you came to the U.S. and what you experienced in terms of the way people treated you, with a bit of that, maybe, I mean, you can speak to this, some of the dynamics that you referenced here, which you witnessed firsthand. Just tell that story if you feel comfortable.
Yeah, of course. You know, I talk about the book, I talk in the book about the fact that I had an arranged marriage when I was 17. I came to the U.S. as a teenage bride. My husband at the time was born in an immigrant family, but was raised essentially in the U.S. And I went to college in the South. And I remember, you know, for instance, like it must have just been the first week, right, where the Southern lady who's teaching English takes me aside, you know, and, you know, outside the classroom after class. And she's like, "Are you okay? Are you all right? Like, do you need help? I can help you. I can be your help." And, you know, it took me years to understand that, you know, she thought of me as like this abused and person that was sort of, you know, in college, but who maybe needed help because she was, you know, facing the issue with that is not that I'm not saying that immigrant women aren't subject to abuse. I worked in a domestic violence shelter where I, you know, worked precisely with immigrant women facing domestic abuse. I'm just talking about, you know, the assumption that I would not know anything about women's rights or empowerment or empowering myself, simply because I had come from Pakistan as a teenager. So that sort of condescension it's rife. It's there all the time. Even now, I You know, even now after I've written books on feminism, and obviously I, you know, I've told my story of how I left an abusive relationship, how, you know, I became a single mom in law school, and then, you know, got myself through the bar, and et cetera. Even after saying all of those things, my feminist credentials are called into question, are considered suspect, simply because I'm brown and Muslim, and I'm not willing to disavow those things. Which, you know, which goes to the central problem, is that we might not explicitly be asking women to become white to be considered feminist, but we are asking women to become white, to be included at least in the feminist conversation, right? Because if you are don't work to be relatable, if you don't pretend, you know, if you want to, for instance, to be taken seriously as an intellectual feminist, right? You shouldn't talk about your personal experience, right? My personal experience living in a shelter, you know, leaving an abusive marriage, et cetera, because within American feminist circles, at least, the people who make the decisions are not the people who have ever fought any kind of frontline battles in terms of their feminist credentials. So there is a gatekeeping of sorts which keeps women who have actually fought these battles, you know, who've been the single moms, who've faced, you know, sexual abuse. There is a very intentional sort of siloing of those women, as, you know, they're brought on again to tell their stories of trauma, but they're not included, for instance, in the board of directors, right? Especially yeah. not if they're public about their trauma.
And before we run out of time, you just talked a little bit about how being a Muslim woman, you weren't able to be perceived as a real feminist. And it just strikes me how, you know, to bring it back to the start of our interview, the concept of white feminism is an extension of capitalism, how capitalism can be, chooses which religion defines empowerment, which skin color is an extension of or what's empowered, right? Which AKA means having power in capitalist society. Gender, of course, as well. But like the white feminism as a part of that whole, I think is the number one takeaway.
Absolutely,
from your book, and of course it spills over into like religion and the portrayal of Islam as inherently wrong in that way.
And that hurts Muslim feminists so much, because their entire project is to try to make Islam egalitarian for women who are within the religion. So, you know, so there are all these constant degradations that are happening. And, you know, it's to take the feminist conversation forward, we absolutely have to recognize that having all these different, like Muslim feminism, Black feminism, et cetera, it doesn't make feminism weaker. It makes feminism stronger, because it means that you're bringing all of those people within a larger discussion so that can be you know, the basis for a collective movement. I mean, one reason why Texas has happened, I mean, it exposes the fact that we don't have a collective, politically relevant feminist movement in this country that we can draw on immediately if you have an attack like that on reproductive rights. So, you know, the impetus is that if we can only start having this conversation about race within feminism, we will have overcome the biggest obstacle to, you know, a true sisterhood that exists today. You know, it is the biggest obstacle. And it's white feminists' insistence that solidarity means listening to them, that I hold responsible for, you know, the condition feminism as a whole is in today.
Well, I really loved your book, and I'm passionate about this topic, and I appreciate the way you communicate it so unabashedly and correctly, in my view. Rafia Zakaria, author of Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. Thank you so much. There you go. There's the book. There's the cover. I like the book, too. I like the cover as well. Thank you so much for your time today, Rafia. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and wrap things up. We are back, and in case you were unaware, last night, despite it being the day before this deadline for the conservative Democrats, the deadline that they set on the vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which we've gone over at length, is a way to kill or significantly water down the progressive priority bill that includes an extension of the child tax credit, climate provisions, universal pre-K, free community college, etc. Many important ideas and concepts, or not just concepts, but actual legislation within that larger package. They chose to still have this congressional baseball game last night, despite this, as I mentioned, being a very tough time in Washington. Toughy works too. Nancy Pelosi was caught on camera at this congressional baseball game, which they have every year. And the commentary may amuse me because Pelosi looks like she's furiously talking on the phone and is pretty pissed off. And yet that wasn't portrayed by the C-SPAN baseball announcers.
It was Roger Davis at the top of the lineup.
Speaker, no doubt, happy about that play. But she is known as a big sports fan, and often after dealing with a lot of really difficult reporter questions related to what's going on in...
A big sports fan. She looks like it. I mean, she is on the phone furiously talking probably to her husband back home in San Francisco. Damn it! Damn it! Look, that should have been called a strike, and it was called a ball. Unreal. That's definitely what she was talking about there. It's super tone deaf to have this congressional baseball game. Not that anyone really cares. Republicans versus Democrats in at the height of these negotiations. But I mean, that's kind of how things go down in D.C. anyway, for the most part. So it's all theater to them anyway. Why not play a game?
If they pass the $3.5 trillion, it looks a lot better.
Yeah, it does. It does. If that congressional baseball game was used to finally get these conservative Democrats to get with the program and get with the Biden agenda, which is the correct framing, then maybe it was a success. But we'll see. All right, folks, this is all the time that we have for today for our Peacock audience. We will see you tomorrow.
You know, the way Rafi was talking about how it's bad to assume non-Christian woman disempowered, it really is the way that, like, the new atheist type anti-Muslim Islamophobic crew, they basically just naturalized the misogyny in those communities and say, like, actually no, this is how they have to be. Not only are they this way now and disregard all of history, say, like, for instance, in Iran and them trying to nationalize their oil or whatever, forget all that, this is what they're holy book has to say.
Mm-hmm.
And you really, like, with enemies of sort of misogynist Islam like that, I mean, who needs friends?
Right. I just wanted to read this IM, or because it was a criticism that I think is good. Hey, Emma, I didn't hear much about trans inclusion and feminism in your interview. Maybe I missed it. That I wrote down a question about that and I did not get to it. I'm really sorry, because I did want to get to it. So that is my bad. And then I will also say Bourbon Socialists, love the interview today, Emma. I definitely think Michael Brooks would have loved the emphasis on international feminist issues and solidarity among feminists. I look forward to Emma Jordy Report Thursdays because of the great work you do in the free half and the laughs with Matt and Brandon, the fun half. Keep up the great work, Thursday crew. Thank you very much.
I may be misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure Michael interviewed Rafia.
Oh, she did. He did?
Yep, I think so.
I'm going to
add Binder and Brandon, by the way.
Okay, yeah, let's add them. And Maumua Cinema says it's a historical map, the way that it's portrayed after, you know, talking about what you said about
Iran. That's what I'm saying, yeah. Disregard any sort of political history or, yeah.
Yes. I've been using your line about, there's somebody in my life who, like, keeps wanting to make, like, talk about just theoretically, philosophically, and I've been using your why use philosophy when you can use history
philosophy's, a little bit. Philosophy is for people too lazy to do history and want all the lessons up front.
I was trying to be polite, but I wanted to go a little bit harder. Hey, Brandon, what's up? You're muted. And maybe you can't hear me. You're having some issues?
Oh, no. I just couldn't click the button properly. That was the only issue. But I could hear you, but I was muted.
Singular issue, right?
Yeah.
How are you guys doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing? Emma, I caught a little bit of the end of your anecdote there. I'm not sure what the beginning was.
Yeah, I was using Matt's sage advice in real-life conversations about philosophy and history, but we just had a really great interview about against white feminism. Some very, very brilliant chatters pointed out that I am, in fact, white. That is accurate. How are you guys doing?
Hello, everybody. I'm doing good, Emma. I didn't get a chance to listen to that interview. I was following the congressional hearing with Facebook right now, where they're being grilled over basically their own research that was leaked that found that apparently Facebook and Instagram might not be good for children's mental health.
Whoa.
Breaking news. Yeah, but it is actually a really interesting hearing. What's his name? Senator Ed Markey. Reintroduced the Kids Act, which basically is his legislation that would deal with some of these problems on a federal level. For example, you know, your favorite, your kid's favorite shows on YouTube or Facebook or whatever, they wouldn't be able to do influencer marketing to them. Like, you know, you don't put on Sesame Street on PBS and see Big Bird, you know, cracking open something like
Four Loko.
No, but like, you know, cracking open like a kid's toy and like playing with it and telling them, oh yeah, get it at, it's a Kmart exclusive, like you do with like, you know, Ryan's toy review on YouTube, for example. So it was always very weird because, you know, it's actually illegal for children to be marketed to on TV in program like that. Yeah. And that's not illegal, apparently, on shows that are broadcast online.
Well, that's good for free speech, right?
Of course.
There was actually a reality show in the early 2000s called Kid Nation, where the entire plot was dropping 100 kids in like a ghost town in Arizona and letting them form like a little Lord of the Flies environment. It's aired on Fox News. And, you know, you can still find episodes of it online places. I can't tell you where. But, you know, it really is just like a libertarian dream there.
That honestly sounds incredible. And you know what, in the fun half, speaking of things you can find online, Matt, we are looking forward to a bit of a recap slash teaser of your debate with the one Michael Tracy.
Oh yeah, this thanks to this show, I debated Michael Tracy last Friday.
so that's a way, a really smooth transition to plug Doomed, and then when we get into the fun half, we can talk a little bit more about the Tracy saga.
For sure. So youtube.com/MattBinder for the live stream version of the show, doomedcast.com for the audio version of the show. There was a great interview last week I did with the author of a new book on Peter Thiel, which you should definitely go check out. And there will be a new live show on the live stream at YouTube tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time. But what everyone wants to know about is the Michael Tracy debate, which you can see on my channel, youtube.com/MattBinder. It's the last thing uploaded. It went up Friday. It was live on his stream. Interestingly, it disappeared and he had to re-upload it. He said tech issues. I'll believe him because it looks like it's fully there. Although you did lose his audience's live chat comments, unfortunately. And they were very...
That's what I'm really interested in, actually. But anyway,
yeah.
I guess we have to go to Rockfin for a few bucks to see the comments there.
Yeah, they were very interesting. Very interesting. I don't judge people by who follows them, but there's if everyone who follows you is the same type of person, then I think then you have to look within and see what are you doing to attract those types of people.
It's my job to judge people by who follows them.
So. And Matt, other Matt, Left Reckoning, what's happening over there?
Last night, Adrian Martinez and Sam Goodman of La Ruta del Clima of Costa Rica, a climate NGO, talked about what we need to be focusing on ahead of COP26 in terms of not letting the big polluters get away with forgetting about, like, let's say they wipe out an entire island because of climate. You can't mitigate that, right? Like, we're going to need to start coughing up some cash. And it's we talk about the dynamic of how these major polluters basically destroy the whole planet, and then to address the issue, we extend financing to everybody else, so we collect out the interest on that, and why that's a little bit messed up. So that was last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning, where we went into not only Sam Harris, but other rationalist podcasters turning on the Weinsteins.
Ooh.
Over this ivermectin stuff. So patreon.com/leftreckoning, we went deep on that, folks.
And Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
We should have a new episode out for patrons this weekend regarding the Havana Syndrome craze, you know, the new dance craze that's sweeping the nation's federal agents, and the vaccine mandate, and all sorts of good things. So, you know, stay tuned.
Whoa, stay tuned. All right, guys. We are about to head into the fun half. Just Trade Coffee, Fair Trade. Shit.
Just Coffee, Fair Trade. coffee.
I haven't memorized that part of Sam's pitch yet, but you know, Just Coffee co-op, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea and Chocolate.
Sounds like you haven't had your Just Coffee yet.
I haven't. I actually ran out of my Just Coffee and I need to order some more. My, that's why I'm drinking cold brew from the evil, evil plastic cup. I couldn't bring it from home. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Rand Paul. I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey Sam, hey Andy, you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.